This is a podcast of Costing the Earth from the BBC. For full terms and conditions, please go to the website at bbc.co.uk.
Hello. Sat with coffee and cake in a garden in leafy West London. Concepts like food shortage and malnutrition can seem like a world away. I mean, 50 years ago, advances in plant science saved the lives of an estimated 1 billion people, and that lifted vast swathes of the planet's population out of hunger. But as the reality of climate change begins to bite, this modern era of unparalleled plenty is under very real threat. From the grass seed in this cake, wheat, to the coffee in my cup, the crops that feed us are facing increasing uncertainty. Plant scientists once again are facing this colossal task in trying to secure humanity's future. And some of this work is going on just meters from where I'm sat. You see, this isn't any garden. This is the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, where I trained as a botanist, and it's home to some of the brightest minds in plant science. On this week's Costing the Earth, I'm uncovering the risks that plants face in our changing climate and how it directly affects our survival. It's the story of how plant geeks could save the world. To find out more, I've come to the incredible treasure trove of plants that's behind the scenes at Kew's Tropical Nursery to meet Professor Kathy Willis, Director of Science here at Kew. We're standing between row after row of thousands of cacti of every imaginable size. Kathy, these are the kind of plants that people think of, perhaps, when they think of climate change. But why are they important?
Well, these plants, particularly all these cactaceae, have got particular adaptations that make them able to withstand drought. And people often think, you know, if you're bad at gardening, you buy a cactus and put it on your windowsill and you're fine because the thing is able to withstand the fact that you never water it. However, there are many traits, sort of characteristics that plants have, not only cacti, that lead plants to be much more resilient to things like increasing temperature, increasing drought, higher CO2. And as part of the State of the World's Plants report for this year, we looked at all the literature that's been published in the last decade, where people have been asked this very question, you know, which plants will be better able to withstand climate change because of their characteristics that enable them to survive these different climatic parameters.
And how does understanding those traits affect how we think about crop plants?
Well, it's an interesting one. I mean, let me give you one example. So one of the findings that we came out from looking at this huge literature review was that plants with deeper roots are better able to withstand drought. Now, many people think, well, that's obvious. But actually, how obvious is that? You know, how often do we think those plants aren't surviving because we've got a drought here? You only need to think about the American Dust Bowl in the 1930s to understand the importance of that. Because the settlers at that time, they took away the prairie grass and they planted wheat. And our prairie grass has really, really deep roots. Wheat has shallow roots. And as a result of that, when you had a drought, the wheat crop collapsed and there was no prairie grass left to replace it to provide the resilience to that landscape. And as a result of that, you had displacement of millions of people and famine. So you really need to understand, you know, which crops then have the right traits to survive with higher temperatures, more drought, higher CO2.
So 60% of all the calories consumed by humanity come from just three grass species. So understanding how you could breed perhaps for wheat with deeper roots or corn with deeper roots could really make a significant difference with the challenges we face.
Absolutely. And another study that was carried out a couple of years ago also showed that it's those plants that are able to store their biomass below ground are better adapted to higher CO2 and drought. So if you start thinking about things like potatoes and many of those below ground yams are another one, these are the crops of the future, cassava, all of these things that actually you wouldn't normally, cassava and yams particularly, find on our table, and yet those are going to be the ones that probably, going forwards, have the inbuilt traits, the inbuilt characteristics that will enable those plants to thrive in this peculiar mixture of climate parameters that we're facing.
So it's not just about breeding the current gambit of crops that we have. It's about selecting and maybe adapting our diets to match future climatic conditions.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also looking right now out there at the much wider environment to say which plants are growing in those more extreme environments. So you started off by talking about coffee. Coffee is a good example. There are some species of coffee in Madagascar, for example, that grow very well at 40 degrees C, whereas our normal coffee we drink, coffee arabica, doesn't really like drought. It doesn't like dryness at the end of its growing season. So maybe we should be looking at those other varieties that are right now wild species and start to bring those into everyday use in order to enable us to have coffee going forwards.
Kathy Willis at the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew, and we'll be hearing more from her later. Introducing drought-resistant traits doesn't just apply to threatened coffee plantations in the tropics, but to the crop here in front of me, in this field in East Anglia. I'm on a farm near Thetford in Suffolk with Andrew Blenkiron, manager of the Euston Estate. Andrew, this has been one of the driest winters in years, and you can really see it in this crop.
Just digging down here now, we're just 20 centimetres down there, and it's still dust all the way down. We've only had 125 millimetres of rain over the last 5 months, which has been significant in terms of the development of particularly our winter cereal crops.
So you can see this field of wheat is significantly stunted. There's large gaps between them, the leaves are rolled up, there's yellowing on them, and there's even dust blowing off the track here, covering the whole area.
Yep.
It's not a typical English scene at this time of year.
Certainly not, and this is one of the effects that we find here, probably 1 year in five, 1 year in six, that the winter cereal crops fail to really get themselves going in the spring. Looking at this crop now, it's down to one or two tillers, so there's only sort of two or three stems on the from one seed that's been planted, as opposed to what we would normally expect of five or six stems at this time of year. So obviously yield has been impacted already. It's very difficult to determine to what effect, because we don't know when it's next going to rain. But I would suggest that already we're seeing at least 20% of the yield being removed from the maximum potential of this crop.
Is there anything you can do about this? Can you irrigate? Can you mitigate that in some way?
We certainly can irrigate, and we do irrigate our higher value crops, but the economic returns associated with irrigating winter cereals is not justifiable. And presently, the soil moisture deficit, so the amount of water it's going to take to get the soil from its very dry state to fully saturated, is going to take about 4 inches, 100 millimetres of water to do that. That'll cost us about £160. There isn't the economic justification. And then, of course, who knows? The weekend could bring 50 millimetres of rain.
It's impossible to really attribute a single dry winter to climate change, but this is certainly characteristic of what certain experts may be predicting. If winters carry on like this, what step are available to you to take?
As you've highlighted, it's difficult to attribute this to climate change. I've been here at Euston 6 years now. 2011, the driest year ever. 2012, the wettest year ever. So, you know, it's very difficult to work out. And in terms of a plant breeder trying to produce us something that's capable of coping with those two extremes, their challenge is significant. I would suggest the biggest challenge is find a variety that will cope with very low levels of rain but be tolerant of being saturated.
Since recording with Andrew Blenkiron in Suffolk, his crops received 50 millimetres of rain in 3 days. But that's still only half of what they need. He says that he'd like to see the development of hardy varieties that can handle both drought and deluge. In the USA, such is the pace of climate change that some plants are flowering a whole month earlier than they did just 50 years ago. And this is prompting a proposed intervention across the state in which plant scientists are actively assisting plants to migrate to new areas. Andrea Kramer is a conservation scientist at the Chicago Botanic Gardens, and she argues that the level of climate change currently experienced in North America is promising to outpace the ability of some plant species to migrate or adapt, leaving them at risk of extinction.
Some modeling work that my colleagues have done at the Botanic Garden have shown that plants may need to move up to 10 kilometers a year in order to just track changing temperatures, let alone changing precipitation patterns and making sure that they're actually in the habitat that they are adapted to. So assisted migration may be looking at moving populations or moving a species into a place where it's never been before based on the projections that we're seeing. But it may also be, and what we've been looking at more closely at the Chicago Botanic Garden, is trying to do things like restoration. So when we're restoring populations or habitat, We are basically selecting the species and the genetic diversity that's going in the ground with the idea that we're creating more healthy and resilient populations that are more connected and more able to respond to climate change and other disturbances that they have to face. And we also want to make sure that there's enough genetic diversity in these populations that they can actually adapt. Those are all three ways that populations can handle the climate change that they're experiencing. And of course, if they don't handle that, then they go extinct.
Andrea Kramer of Chicago Botanical Gardens, speaking to me from Illinois. Andrea was explaining the need to capture the genetic diversity in wild plant species. But she also says that the U.S. Seeds of Success program, as it's called, their seed bank, just doesn't have enough seed in it to support this massive scale of assisted migration that they want to undertake. Well, Colin Club is head of conservation science at Kew, and he updated me on their Millennium Seed Bank scheme, which collaborates with nearly 100 countries all over the world. And their latest seed count shows they have seed of over 37,000 species from 190 countries, held at sites all over the world. Standing beside the lush green foliage of a banana plant, we discussed how limited the gene pool of the bananas we eat is based on, and the risks associated with that.
What we have as a commercial banana plant has a very narrow genetic range to it, which makes it potentially susceptible to viruses, bacteria, pests and diseases. So one of the broad programs that we've got is looking at particularly crop wild relatives and trying to conserve seeds, so the genetic diversity in seeds, by collecting its closest relatives, its sisters, brothers, cousins. And banana is one of 29 gene pools that we're looking at in the Crop Wild Relatives Project, working with the Crop Diversity Trust.
So to most people, you slice open a banana, you don't see any seeds. So what's there to save?
Well, that, of course, is what we see with many crops that have been, highly bred over the years for particular uses and particular traits. And so bananas are one of those ones that have lost their seeds. So we're going back to the actual wild species and the nearest relatives, which are certainly bananas you wouldn't want to eat. They're tiny little hard fruits, which are mostly big black seeds.
Like ball bearings, aren't they?
Exactly.
With almost
exactly.
No sweet flesh.
None at all. So the commercially produced banana is a long way from the wild species. And, of course, the danger of that is that potentially we've lost a lot of those traits which a wild species might have had to be able to withstand threats in the future, be it climate change, be it pests and diseases, etc. So we're looking back towards the origins of many of these crops to try and see, can we get material into the Millennium Seed Bank for long-term ex-situ conservation within the bank? And that is secure then. It's like an insurance policy for the future. And this material would then be available in the future for future breeders, for research, for conservation.
And this threat is real. So it's happened before. About 50, 60 years ago, there were two different key varieties of banana. One of them is now extinct. We're only left with just one individual. And it's happened before with the potato, for example. Yep. A very limited base of the potato made it susceptible to blight, which was one of the causes of the Irish potato famine. And potatoes are in your collection.
They are. Well, the potato wild relatives.
The potato wild relatives, funnily enough, what we would describe as the potato is actually not one species, but quite a few species and lots of crosses of that species, if you're going to get technical. What work are we doing to keep the potato safe?
We're not directly working on the potato. We leave that to the crop research institutions, and there is a very important one on potatoes. But we would work with them to identify these crop wild relatives and through that begin to try and identify traits that some of these near relatives might have that would be useful to be incorporated into the next set of varieties that we might use.
Colin Club, beneath a broad-leafed banana plant in a humid glasshouse at Kew. Very different from this Cambridgeshire field where I am now, looking at crop trials being conducted by Phil Howell at NIAB's Research Farm. That's the National Institute of Agricultural Botany. Phil, you've been successfully reintroducing the genes from a crop wild relative of wheat goat grass into modern commercial varieties. But why? I mean, looking at it, it doesn't look promising.
You're absolutely right. I've got a block here which shows you what hopefully we'd be seeing as the crop nears maturity in the summer. So this is what goat grass looks like, and it's still not very impressive. But goat grass actually carries 1/3 of the chromosomes of modern elite bread wheat varieties.
So it's a sort of a quarter the thickness. Yep. There are very, very few seeds. It really just looks like a shrunken, unpromising, not very calorie-packed version.
Exactly. And you wouldn't grow that as a food crop. But if, with a genetics hat on, if you were to look at all of the wheat varieties across the world, a global collection, and you were to look at the genetic diversity within them, you would see for two of the three sets of chromosomes a reasonable amount of diversity. But for this third set, which we call, in genetics, we call it the D genome of wheat, there's very little diversity. So the ancient hybridization between goat grass and actually a precursor of pasta wheat, durum wheat, that happened about 10,000 years ago in the wild, but it only happened a handful of times. So it's like a massive bottleneck in diversity. So what we're trying to do is recreate that very rare cross from 10,000 years ago and introduce new sources of diversity from the goat grass that have otherwise escaped.
People think about wheat as an individual species, but it's really a very, very old hybrid. And by going back to that original cross, you can create more genetic diversity in that.
That's the idea. Now, most of that new diversity that we create will be, in agricultural terms, completely useless. But there will be some gems in there, and that's part of our job, and working closely with commercial breeders, is to look for those interesting and useful traits in there. I think we are seeing more extreme weather events at a higher frequency. So we might have a very wet winter and then a dry spring, dry summer. And it's very hard to select for waterlogging tolerance in the autumn, winter, and drought tolerance in the summer.
Also joining me is Richard Summers, chairman of the British Society of Plant Breeders. If you suddenly need to have a large variety of crops very, very quickly, what happens? What are the mechanics behind that?
That's an interesting question in terms of covering the way we might run individual programs and also the portfolio that a company like mine, I work for a company called RGT, the portfolio of crop wheat varieties we might have across Europe. So as Phil said, wheat came about by this fairly rare natural hybridization event 10,000 years ago. Selection through early agriculturalists, systematic plant breeding through the last century to today, has given us a very diverse base of wheat, which is adapted to be grown all over the world. So in Europe, we have programs based in Spain, France, Germany, UK. So we have material adapted to be grown in southern Spain, which is clearly going to be very different from the material that grows in northern Europe and in the UK. So that immediately gives us a portfolio of material adapted for those geographic zones. And clearly, one of the responses breeders of commercial varieties can do is to use that portfolio approach to introduce variability and adaptability across those geographic zones.
So you can just move around things that are existingly better adapted to other climates. Is it as simple as bringing maybe an Italian or a Spanish variety to the UK as the climate is predicted to perhaps warm?
Certainly some of the genes and some of the characters which allow wheat to grow well in southern Europe can be transferred into northern Europe. Of course, there's the other advantage is that we can test some of our UK bred material into those environments to see, even though the variety might be well adapted to the UK, how well does it cope in a hotter, drier environment. One of the issues we have, though, within that base is how to then extend the diversity that we can play with. So we've got a lot of diversity available. We can use that to inform our forward breeding. But as we start to understand the genetics behind that diversity, we actually want to come to someone like Phil to see if there's novel diversity that hasn't yet been used in our breeding. But I am, in the short to medium term, I'm very optimistic about what we have in our current wheat germplasm pool, our commercial pool, to allow us to get some adaptation. But looking much further into the future, in 10 or 20 years, we know that some of the genes we need are probably not present in current commercial varieties.
Richard Summers and Phil Howell at NIAID at Cambridge, thank you. You're listening to Costing the Earth, and I'm James Wong, a botanist looking at how plant scientists are responding to the challenges of climate change. Now, Kew has been conducting a really extensive review of the current literature in order to identify those traits in plants that might predispose them to a greater risk of extinction than others. I met Ema Nicklua in their herbarium, this vast Victorian library of dried press plants, whose earliest specimens date back to 1700. The 7 million items are still being studied and added to by a good 2,000 new plant discoveries every single year. And Ema told me that one type of plant that's at specifically increased risk of extinction are epiphytes. These are plants such as orchids or ferns that live on trees, clinging to their bark without parasitizing them.
That doesn't mean that every single orchid or every single epiphytic fern is more vulnerable, but that there's something going on there that seems to make them more vulnerable to extinction.
And what about the perceived risk of plants that are pollinated by insects?
Many plants are pollinated by insects, and we don't think that our data show that all of them are at risk of extinction. Far from it. But specialising in being pollinated by a particular insect or a particular group of insects does appear to put a plant at slightly higher risk of extinction. And we think that may be to do with the business of insects being under pressure from extinction as well, and perhaps from other things such as changing seasons. So if you rely on a particular insect or a particular group of insects, and you become disconnected from your insect pollinator for whatever reason, perhaps their distribution is changing, then your life cycle is broken at that point and you're less likely to succeed in reproduction and therefore potentially at greater risk of extinction over time.
How does our ability to understand how these different traits interact with the natural world actually turn into measurable things that humanity can do?
That's exactly why we're doing it, because if we carry on just doing species by species, many species are likely to be extinct before they've had their extinction risk evaluated, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So our focus on the traits that we can see readily and associate with extinction risk is helping us to decide where to allocate our efforts.
So in some cases, there are things that are at risk of going extinct before we even realise they're threatened, before we've even recorded what they are.
Almost certainly, yes. Having worked in Brazil for my PhD field studies 20 years ago, I now pass areas where patches of forest where I found one exciting thing and would have hoped to go back and find more exciting things are no longer there. So almost certainly we're losing species, sometimes before they've even been described to science and certainly before they've been had their extinction risk evaluated.
When I worked in Malaysia, some of the botanists identify the first time they've ever seen an orchid is at a roadside vendor when someone's just ripped them off a tree. And they don't find them in the jungle, but they find them on stalls by the road.
Absolutely. I'm trained as a taxonomist, so to identify and classify species. That moment when in the group that you're expert in, you find a new species in the field, as distinct from encountering one in the herbarium, when you find it in the field, it's this golden moment where you think, oh my goodness, look at this, it's different. And then when you look around and realise I'm on a tiny patch of forest between a housing estate and a municipal rubbish dump, and you look around for more of the same species, you don't find it, there's a high probability that species in that situation will be gone in 10 or 20 years.
If you have, you know, a mine that needs to be set up in an area, we all like our smartphones, does it matter that an orchid, a pretty flower, is going to go when we can have nice boner works?
I think absolutely it matters, because every species we lose thousands of years of nature experimenting to find a new solution to a new problem. We won't have that time to find all the solutions to all the problems of the future. Nature's done a lot of those experiments for us. We shouldn't be letting them go without a fight. The first rule of intelligent tinkering is that you don't throw away any of the parts just because you don't know what they're for.
Ema Nicklua in Kew's herbarium. But what happens to those plants that experience a shift in climate and have to therefore adapt to living amongst unfamiliar, perhaps more vigorous species? That's what Professor Vigdis Vanvik at the University of Bergen in northern Norway is finding out with an intervention study. Her and her colleagues are moving whole patches of an ecosystem down a mountain to live in warmer conditions, along a line, a transect, and observing what happens. Not just in Norway, she's also running a comparative study on a mountainside in China's eastern Himalayas, in the Gonga Mountains, both of which are alpine environments.
What happens when it gets warmer is that the alpine species, they are actually, in the beginning, they look quite happy. So they grow better, they produce larger flowers, more flowers, everything seems to be going okay. But the problem is that while they're standing there, they're getting new neighbors. And those new neighbours are lowland species. And the lowland species, what they do is instead of investing the resources in flowers, they invest the resources in stems and leaves. So for the first couple of years, they don't look so great. But after a short time, they are able to outgrow the alpine species and compete for the resources in a better way. So I think about these things a little bit like the alpine species have a Catholic strategy. When there's a good year, they invest everything in seeds and flowers, and then they hope that, you know, this is going to pay off in the future. But the lowland species are more like Protestants, so they are more sort of investing in leaves and architecture and in the photosynthetic machinery. And then in the long run, that makes them outgrow the more optimistic alpine species.
I love that analogy. So in many ways, the very specific adaptations that alpine species have, they exist for a reason. They don't work anywhere else. Would you say that almost in that sense, mountains act like islands? Things can move up the mountain as climate change happens, but eventually they get to a point where there's not really anywhere to go.
Yeah, that's exactly the point. The specific adaptations that make species so successful in the alpine environment, they are able to exploit the odd good year, for example, the odd warm year. They're able to really reproduce then. They're also able to tolerate really harsh and stressful conditions for a long time. All those things is exactly what becomes the problem for them when the climate gets warmer and you don't have a good year just every now and then, but you have it every year, because then other species come in and they take over. And so basically the alpine species are then pushed up and up the mountains until finally they have nowhere else to go.
Vigdis Vanvik on mountain transect experiments in Norway and China. Back at the tropical nursery at Kew, in between rows and rows of cacti, I've got one last question for you, Professor Cathy Willis. As Director of Science at Kew, you're the best person to ask, how hopeful do you feel about the future of plants?
Well, I think as you've demonstrated from all your interviews, there is no silver bullet. That we have to have many different approaches and come at this from all sorts of angles. But I am hopeful. I think we will get there. Plants have got an incredible plasticity in there. We've got huge variety of species from the crop wild relatives right the way through to new economically important species of food, for timber, etc., etc. So I think we will have resilient plants for the future, but we need to have people doing the science on them to understand what leads to resilience. What is it about the plants from the genetic level through to their traits, to their roots, to their leaves, that means that those plants are going to be the winners, and those are the ones that we need to be focusing on.
So whether humankind disappears tomorrow or not, plants will always carry on. But what matters is understanding the plants that we rely on, the plants that we need to eat.
Absolutely. If you look at the deep time record, plants have always been around. They have survived incredible mass extinction of animals. We've still had those plants in there. So plants have incredible resilience to climatic perturbations. But we need to know which ones we rely on, which are those ones, and can we please make sure we protect those?
To me, in many ways, caring about plants is a selfish act, because plants will carry on regardless of us, but we can't carry on without plants.
Well, that's all a part of the so-called natural capital debate. It's understanding which plants are important for human well-being. And therefore, when you're thinking about biodiversity conservation, it's not just about the beauty of plants. Plants are beautiful. But it's also understanding what do those plants provide for all aspects of life on Earth, from the air we breathe through to the food and the drugs that we use.
That was a podcast of Costing the Earth from the BBC.